a peace, we're going mainstream. Everybody's gonna eat, we're going mainstream. All my family is sick. See you on Main Street, we're going mainstream.
From Wall Street to Melrose Avenue,
we're going mainstream.
Venture capitalists to athletes to
we're
creators.
Going mainstream.
To the person who's collected trading cards.
Welcome back to the Alt Goes Mainstream podcast. Today, we have the operator's view on the podcast. We bring in someone who rose up the ranks of a private equity-backed software company to be CEO of that company, ECI Software Solutions, that now generates over $500 million in revenue and $200 million in EBITDA. We welcome Ron Books, now an operating executive at Carlyle and the CEO at NetHealth, Carlyle portfolio company. He also sits on a number of boards for Carlyle. He's also the chairman and former CEO of ECI Software Solutions, a leading global provider of cloud-based software for SMEs, which he successfully sold to Leonard Green & Partners for a multi-billion dollar exit. Ron started with ECI when it was a startup company and rose in the organization to serve as VP of Sales, then COO, then CEO, a position which he held from 2009 to 2021. While serving as CEO, Ron and his team developed and executed a strategic plan that included overseeing 41 M&A transactions and a successful software license to cloud migration across nearly a dozen platforms. Over the years, they received investment from NEA, Accel, Insight Partners, Carlyle, Apex Partners, Goldman Sachs, and most recently sold the business to Leonard Green & Partners. Under his leadership as CEO, ECI grew from less than $50 million in revenue to over $500 million in revenue and has sold the company in 2020 at a multi-billion dollar valuation. Ron has all the hallmarks of a successful entrepreneur: energetic yet thoughtful, a tireless work ethic, the ability to connect with customers and employees, and loyalty to both customers and employees. Ron and I had a fascinating conversation about what it takes to build a great company and culture and how to work with private equity, given that he's been on both sides of the table. We discussed lessons learned from growing a business to $500 million in revenue and $200 million in EBITDA, how he built and grew ECI through acquisitions and globalizing the business, why culture matters and how to vet for culture in the hiring process, stories from the challenges and successes of integrating 41 companies via M&A, how founders should think about working with private equity firms, how founders can get the most out of their board members and operating partners, and the transition from CEO to operating executive and back to CEO. Thanks, Ron, for coming on the show to share your wisdom and experiences that are an invaluable source of learnings for both founders and investors. Ron, welcome to the Alt Goes Mainstream podcast.
Thanks, Mike. We're good to be here.
Likewise, great to see you and pleasure to have you on. You have such a rich set of experiences as both an operator and now as an operating partner and now back as an operator. Would love to start there. You have this incredible background from early days as an employee at a company, ECI. You're still the chairman now. You became CEO after being sales, head of sales, COO, then CEO, and grew it into a successful multi-billion dollar business. Walk us through the early days of your career and how you helped build ECI.
When I joined ECI, I was actually the 32nd employee. We had $0 in revenues. It was VC-backed at the time, NEA and Accel Partners. What ECI does, we license end-to-end technology solutions for small to medium-sized businesses in specific vertical markets. We were VC-backed. We grew to about $29 million in revenue and $9 million in EBITDA in 2006. And that's where we had our first move into private equity. Sold to Insight Venture Partners in 2006. Took a minority investment from Goldman Sachs in 2010, sold to the Carlyle Group in 2014, sold to Apex Partners in 2017, and ultimately in the end of 2020, sold to Leonard Green Partners. So it's been quite a ride.
That's an incredible ride, and I think so many interesting perspectives and learnings to unpack. First, starting with your background, you went from a salesperson to ultimately CEO. Do you think that is the right path for a CEO? Are you glad you had the sales experience as CEO? You also became an operator too and were the COO. What do you think is best to have that path and journey to be a well-prepared CEO for your first time in the seat?
Yeah, mine's interesting too at how I ended up on the operations side. Really a pivotal part of my career. My passion was in sales. I was a sales rep. And even at ECI, when I first came over, I was running as a director of sales, then VP of sales for the organization. And in 2004, I think, or five, the then CEO had to make a decision between consolidating VP of sales. There was me and one other guy, and he ended up choosing the other guy to run sales. Of course, my reaction was I thought I was better and they were close friends, and I was all sort of bitter and frustrated at the decision. I was going to leave ECI. And at the time, he's like, why don't you take over operations instead? And I knew nothing about operations. So after contemplating for a while, I'm like, you know what? I'll give it a shot. It was really pivotal because it gave me a different perspective. I got to learn R&D and product management and customer support, professional services, and I never had that side. I got to see what happened after you delivered a sale. I think it made me a much more complete executive that it led to me taking over as CEO at the end of 2008 and 2009. Now, if you ask me, I'm a little bit more biased towards sales. I think that you're always selling. You're selling yourself. You're selling your people. I even think you're selling as you think about M&A. We do a lot of M&A, and you're trying to convince somebody to choose your company for their employees and their business that they've fostered for many years. So I think sales is critical, but the operation side is just as important as well. But I love the sales background.
What did the former CEO see in you that you may have not seen in yourself when deciding to make you COO?
I don't know. That's a great question. I think I was always diligent. And even as a VP of sales, I'd love to participate in advisory councils or understand what the pain points were of the customer base. I think he saw that side. He wanted to keep me at the company. So that was an opportunity to do that. When he offered to me, I thought he was crazy, but it worked out. I wouldn't be a CEO if it wasn't for that transition.
What was your mindset of stepping into the role as CEO, particularly from the perspective of you'd gone through multiple iterations of having new investors involved in the company and on the board? How did you approach handling and dealing with the private equity firms who were investors in the business at the time?
Private equities gets a little bit of a bad rap. People think it's cutthroat or they're not trying to take care of their employees. I've had the complete opposite experience. I had some great private equity firms I've worked with, but it was a partnership. And yes, each one of them had a uniqueness and they would have different offerings of how much they were involved of the participation. But you learn the nuances of each of the private equity firms as it goes along. We were a little longer in the whole period of Insight Venture Partners. After that, it was every 2 to 3 years, we would have a new PE firm coming in. And the part I liked was it was like getting a new fresh perspective and look at the business with each exit. We would capitalize that and we would leverage each firm and try to leverage their resources and their people to just get better. So I actually liked the relationship.
How did you think about adding a new private equity partner to the business at each phase of the business and the growth of ECI?
It is totally different operating a business that's 50 million in revenue versus 200 million revenue versus 500 million in revenues. To scale, you had to get a lot more disciplined around process and systems, infrastructure and integration and all those type of things. But the good news is these private equity firms had this experience. They were working and scaling with other businesses. And whether we were in office products or healthcare, you're still having the same types of challenges. So they would help us with that scale. And secondarily, and I thought this was a really good perspective, you have to build a great leadership team around you. I tried forever. I was a micromanager in the beginning. I had to participate in every meeting and every decision that things couldn't get done if I wasn't involved. And it was not going to scale. And I learned to just pick great people around me. The private equity firms would tell me what great was or look at the organization and say, here's where there's opportunities. And as I surrounded myself with great people and empowered them, the opportunity to scale was significantly better.
On that point, so much of investing and company building is about people and working with great people. What did you look for in people you would hire to see whether they'd be a great fit for your team?
I can't remember who said this. It might have been the CEO of Starbucks, but I always think of it as like-minded people that have the complementary skill sets. And that's what we had. If you looked at our team, we were definitely not the same person. Each of us had our different unique perspectives and really value proposition. I think it was the combination of us that made us so good, but we had the same initiative. We had the same drive. We had the same sort of culture. We agreed upon the type of people we wanted to be and what type of business we wanted to be. I think those parts complemented each other very well, but we definitely brought different perspectives to the table, which I think was what made us successful.
There a specific skill that you'd look for when interviewing all these different executives who ended up working on your team that there was a common thread as to why each of them were the right fit and why they were successful?
When I interview, I normally know within the first 10 minutes if this has a chance. I don't know if it's a gut feel. There was never anything where I was like, they've got to say this or be this or do this in order to be a fit on our team. But within 10 minutes, I think it had to do with personality and just the vibe and how you connected. That part was critical to me. I'm looking back and thinking of all the people that I hired over the years and the people I worked with. In the first 10, 15 minutes, you would have a general idea of if they were a fit.
What would you say is your favorite interview question to ask?
Oh, man, that is a tough one. I don't even know. I'm so not by the book. I like to go off on tangents and just talk about random things and see how they respond. It's not like, let me sell me this pencil or anything like that. That's never been my style. I try to get them talking about stuff that's less focused on the business and more just about life in general. And if we click, then you start diving into the business side. But you could sort of tell good people immediately. Obviously, you have to check references and get an idea. I always find people that have been hired over and over again by former leaders, like they came back and brought them. I always call it the Mike Holmgren theory of the Green Bay. When he left Green Bay and went to Seattle, he went back and got all the people that were great from Green Bay.
On the flip side, how would you interview the private equity firms that you ended up working with? Because it's hard to think about this when you're the one selling, trying to get an investor to invest into your business. But the reality is that it's a two-way street and you're selling them, but they're also selling you. And that's just as important because it's got to be a fit. How did you evaluate at each point in time why and how the private equity firms you worked with were the right fits for the business?
It's a good question. If I look at each one, like Insight Venture Partners, we are literally defining what we were going to be as ECI. We didn't even know at that point. So they were helping us define that. The Carlyle Group had just went through a license to cloud transition and we were going through a license to cloud transition. So they had that expertise and they helped us make that step. Apex Partners, I thought we just were coming out of that license to cloud business transition and we were humming as a business. We built the infrastructure, we had the process, we had the systems, and they were really focused on accelerating growth. My former boss, Jason Wright, he was a bulldog. He just wanted to go after M&A and there was no bad M&A deals. And when Leonard Green bought us, it's not like they can't bring things to the table because they can, but we're just much more mature. I think we've worked out a lot of the kinks, but we just recently rolled out an ECI shares program that was options or shares for everybody in the company. And it was a unique push up. And this was their program that they had in other portfolios. So each firm brought something unique and that always makes part of the decision where you're at in your continuum.
What advice would you give to founders as they're thinking about working with private equity? The more nuanced aspect of this question is, I think the venture world is maturing and kind of moving upstream a little bit. It's institutionalizing itself. Yes. Private equity has, in some respects, moved downstream a bit to also encompass growth. Now, sure, in some cases, that might be majority investments. Many of the firms you mentioned have majority growth investments, but there's also some minority investments. So the nuance to this question that I'm asking is really, how should a firm think about the right time to work with private equity versus venture? Where do those things all fit in the right time for the business?
ECI left VC and moved to private equity in 2006. At that time, it was pretty clear the stage we were at our business, we were much more profitable at that point. Looking for profitable growth. We're 12% recurring revenue growth. So it's not like a 20, 30%. As you get to be a $500 million business, that's more material and it gets harder to do. But I think we're a profitable growth business. We're going to throw off EBITDA. We're going to leverage the EBITDA and cash flow to do more M&A. We're going to optimize those M&A opportunities like these founder-led businesses that don't have a lot of sophistication. So we can sort of push our professionalism on them, create an expense manage, and then we could leverage that cash flow and EBITDA to do more M&A. I think for us, it was a natural fit for PE at that point. But yes, you're right. I think the lines are blurred more now and PEs are definitely going downward. VCs are coming up.
Yeah, it's an interesting trend, but also then I think that gets to the company fund fit. What you just said, you were a very acquisitive firm. That may in part be due to the market that you were in and why it made sense to roll up a lot of these smaller founder-led businesses. On that point, how much did you try to develop that skill and muscle in-house of being an acquisitive firm versus leveraging private equity firms and their platforms to help you do that?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And it was the last area as the CEO that I had to learn what to do with M&A. And I love it. I think we're at 46 acquisitions at ECI. So we've done a lot of M&A and we believe in it. And we love this parallel approach of organic growth with a combination of inorganic growth. I like that. We started focusing in the early stages of bringing the expertise in-house. They would help us for sourcing. And we gave them the type of businesses we were looking for. They have all these people pounding phones and looking for these type of opportunities. But even as you progress further along, the use of expert networks or trying to diligence differently, the firms would help us with that. we have the muscle internally, and yes, we would leverage them and use them and bounce ideas off them, but we made the decision ultimately because we were responsible for post-acquisition strategy.
Building that muscle internally, did that mean hiring from private equity to bring it in-house?
Yeah, we actually had both. We had some people that came within private equity. We had people that worked in other private firms, even within our core team, our CFO, president, CTO. We learned with every experience what you needed to do a successful M&A. And we just got better and better with each experience. Nothing beats experience. I think we learned it while leveraging PE at the same time because they have expertise there.
What do you think have been the biggest learnings from doing over 40 M&A deals as a business? What are the hardest parts of doing those deals? What do you really have to look for to be able to do it well?
You look at history, you try to understand what the trends are. You're underwriting the future. That's the initial part of it. But for us, it was really understanding post-acquisition fit. Where did it fit in ECI? We were unique because we're organized by vertical markets. We have a manufacturing division, a field service division, a distribution division, a manufacturing division. Each one of those are divisions with division presidents and leadership teams. So if we did an M&A, it often would fall in one of those divisions. So we would leverage the expertise within that division to actually help source that. Then they would be responsible for post-acquisition strategy. Everybody would have to buy in. So our learning was make sure the people that were actually going to input and do the post-acquisition strategy were involved from the get-go. And we leveraged that a lot.
How early did you, as a business, start to think about becoming an acquisitive firm? And how early should firms start thinking about, okay, we're at this size organically, let's think about other ways that we can grow?
Even the previous CEO was acquisitive. He had an M&A background. So for us, it was always sort of part of ours, and we really evolved the muscle to do 46 acquisitions. But I think the part that we did differently when I took over as CEO is we were almost a little bit of a sloppy roll-up initially. We weren't integrating a lot. And post-acquisition-wise, a lot of the time the business would run on their own. We developed a different strategy over the years. It's within 90 days, they're on our systems, they're on our CRM software, they're integrated to our reporting. We have our business applications like our e-commerce solutions or mobile applications, and we would look to integrate those into their solution right away. So I think we got better at the integration side, which then helped streamline the efficiencies and the expense opportunities within the division to make it more profitable. So I think we got better at that, and it was a learning for us for a while.
You talk about making integration work well and doing all the things kind of from a blocking and tackling perspective that you can do. But there's the other side of it, which just like hiring for your own team, you're hiring for bringing these people into your business. How would you go about assessing cultural fit?
Yeah, that's a good one. I think it's the hardest. At ECI, when we were sort of a combination of a bunch of different organizations, I don't think we had a complete culture at first. And one of my HR leaders, when I hired him, was probably around 2012 or so, started focusing on the culture side. And we defined our core values. We understood our corporate goals every year. We understood what we wanted to be as a business and people. And we would hire and fire and acquire based on those type of cultures. We really developed a culture at ECI. And then we recognized that when we were acquiring another culture, they just can't overnight fit into your culture. We had to make sure they felt like part of the company, that they were part of the team, that they quickly learned our processes and people, and we integrated them.
You're bringing up a really interesting point, which is coming up with a company's core values and constantly finding ways to instill that into both existing employees and newer employees, whether through hiring or acquisition. It seems like it's something that everybody talks about, but how do you actually go about doing that?
It's a good question. And we actually present this. When we're selling ECI, we presented our core values and how we implement that across the company. It became truly part of our DNA. When you would log in the morning, our core values would show up on their screen. We went out and got recognition software. And every time an employee goes on, they have so many points per month that they can give to another employee, and they could recognize them for doing anything that was around any of our core values. And they had to assign a core value to that. And then other people can actually see that recognition, and they could, almost like Facebook, they can like it, or they can bump it up, or they can add more points. And then you could leverage those points to actually buy stuff in the store. So truly became part of our culture to implement these core values.
How do you balance the gamification of core values, which operationalizes it, with the element of politics? You don't want people to do it just because they know they're going to get rewarded.
We used to joke the other way around. My present COO was a stickler. He would quiz you in the middle of one of our presentations and call on somebody to tell us about the core values and what each one of them mean. And we don't want it out of fear or the fact that you're going to be a stickler. It's because we say it in our pitch. We really wanted to make it part of the organization. I think if you have the right people and leaders that can do that, that helps a lot. It does become part of how do we promote people? How do we hire people? Ultimately, how do you fire people and get people out of the organization that don't fit your core values? You have to make it part of your business. And until you do that, you're right. It's just a poster or it's a slide. It means nothing. It takes an effort. And I actually thought, Michael, at first, I'm like, it's sort of silly. It's not. It's actually very real and it becomes really much a part of your business and your growth.
Was there a point in the growth of ECI from a FTE perspective in terms of number of people you had where culture became a different challenge to manage?
Yeah, I don't think it was as much the number of people. I think for us, realizing that we're a little fragmented because we work in these different vertical markets that have different products and different customers you're selling to, we're already starting off a little siloed. So we had to eliminate that silo and we made it so that the manufacturing division president will share ideas with the field service division president. It becomes part of that type of culture is the best idea wins. And when we can share information across vertical markets or even centers of excellence, then we do that. And that's really has helped us a ton.
How do you transmit the culture that you've built and want to continue to build as you get a new investor into the business? How do you show that new private equity investor who you're working with that this is how we operate? Because that then cascades down into how the board member operates with you as the management team, how the operating partners, how they're brought in and they help. So how do you think about that?
We actually made it part of our presentation. We really discussed our core values and how it was rolled out, especially in the last process. I give Leonard Green Partners a ton of credit. It was important to them. We had the investment team that came out and was looking at the business and had put in the bid and were fighting for the deal. And then we went and had to do a presentation for their entire organization at the very end. And one of the top questions from their team was around culture, which was like for us, it's always around financials or how are you going to grow the business or how are we going to underwrite the business? It was not. It was around culture. And I think they lead with culture. So I think it's becoming more important even with private equity firms to make sure that the foundation is there.
Is there a way for the board member or operating partners who are spending time with a business to really get a pulse on culture, not just at these moments in time, these dots, but also linearly as you kind of spend more time with the business? Because I'm thinking about this from the investor perspective. You're not necessarily ever close enough to the business to know what's going on day to day.
Yeah.
And yet you want to be able to understand and see change in both. Maybe the management team, they act differently for some reason because they're stressed or whatever it is. And then understanding that, and then you have to get to why and how and what do you do to fix it? How does the sitting on the other side of the table, which you now also do, how do you figure out a way as a board member, operating partner to understand the culture of the business so that you can really feel the heartbeat of the company?
Thinking about it as an operating partner, Jason Wright, who is my former boss at Apex Partners, he teaches a class at the University of Miami, private equity class, which I thought, just imagine being in college and going to a private equity class. I never had that kind of opportunity, which I think is great. So he teaches one and he asked me to be a guest speaker. And he wanted me to talk about, as part of that, my main thing was I've worked with a number of private equity firms. What are the nuances and uniquenesses of each firm? And I did talk about some are more detailed oriented or some want to get in your business. The ones that add the most value are the ones who actually get to learn your nuances, your business, not come and do like, here's the metrics everybody needs to meet. They understand your market. They understand your customers. They understand your people and they understand your culture, your core values or your business. And the ones that got to know it, we would be willing to take any type of advice that we possibly could. And they were always helpful for us in advancing ECI. And the ones that didn't get to know it were less valuable. And it becomes a consulting firm. And CEOs don't want operating advisors that are coming in and say, oh my God, you're 14% of revenue and you're the expense. That's what you got to solve. I feel like getting to know the business and the people is critical.
What were the most effective ways that the private equity firms who did this best were able to accomplish that?
This just popped in my head as you were saying that. I'll bring up Apex again, but really, if I think about each one and why I've had such a good partnership, it's because we had good relationships. We had people relationships. They actually cared about the people as much. Of course, they have to care about their LPs and making a business successful, but they got to know us as people. And I was just thinking of this. It's sort of funny is that when we were acquired by Apex Partners, Jason Wright had our board meeting was at his place in the Hamptons. We literally went, our leadership team and our division presidents all of us went and presented in his house at the Hamptons, and we hung out and we went on some boat trip and all the things that bonded us beyond just running a firm. Then you want to win. You want to win for the other side because you actually know them personally and they want to win for you. So it gets to be so much more aligned from a people perspective. And it's critical on both sides. It's critical with your PE firms. It's critical within your organization. As you get to know the people, if you can foster that, then it becomes so much more successful.
After successfully selling ECI to Leonard Green, you became the chairman, but you decided to join a private equity firm, Carlyle, as an operating partner. Tell us why you decided to do that.
I finally left the business in the beginning of 2021. Some of it was for personal reasons, and we had just finished COVID, which was quite a sort of world to be running a company in. And then right after that, we went into selling ECI. I needed a break. I actually took about 8 months off from the day-to-day operations. I moved into the chairman role. And then when I finally resurfaced, I started to consider what's my next step in life. I had about 10 firms, software private equity firms, reach out to me to be an operating advisor, and all great firms. I ended up going with Carlyle. I had a relationship with them. I knew the people. One of my good friends over there, Steve Bailey, is a managing director. I felt comfortable with the firm and I liked the way they handled ECI as well. It was sort of a natural fit. And now here I was for a certain time period on the other side of it, trying to give advice to people like myself.
What about the way that Carlyle handled ECI and operates as a firm attracted you to working with them?
Yeah, it goes back to the people side. I felt like we were friends first, and then we were business colleagues later. And don't get me wrong, our leadership team has a lot invested in the business. We have to be successful. They have to answer to people, their LPs, so they have to be successful on their front. But we were doing it as a sort of a team. And I think it's been that way for most of the private equity firms, if not all of them that I've worked with. But I just like the relationship we had. We stayed in touch after we exited. They're a minority investor through the Apax Investments. I just got to know them well. I liked the people, and I felt it was a great place for me to land.
What is an operating partner mean to you? I bet every firm has their own definition of what that means. What does that mean for you specifically in the role that you sit in today?
I always flip it and think, okay, when I was the CEO, what could I have benefited from of an operating partner when I was an operator? And it goes back to what I said before, getting to know their business is number one. I always tell the people that I'm working with is that you probably figured that out already. I'm not the smartest person in the room. You're working with all these people that are super smart, Ivy League grads, private equity people, and a lot of smart executives out there. The thing is, we stubbed our toe. We went through a lot of these transitions. We went through the scale. We made the mistakes. And I try to say, if there was somebody there that could have helped me work my way through these mistakes or avoid those mistakes and get ahead of them, I would have leveraged that in a minute. So that's the way I approach it from an operating partner. Where can I help guide them past these areas that I knew that I struggled with when I was an operator?
How much are you also spending time coaching or providing real world experience to the investors? Because you mentioned some investors obviously have operating experience, but not all do. So
yes.
How much time do you spend coaching investors on what it was really like? Because I think you can only get that experience from actually doing it.
No, I agree 100%. And once again, super smart people, but their job is to invest and move on to the next investment. And our job is that we have to actually live with that and we have to turn it into something after the fact. I think there is a respect on the private equity side of people that have actually done it. And I found that they leverage people like myself and other operators because we have that experience. They're looking for the ways they know they have not done it. They're looking for the ways to do that. Our job is to help give that perspective. And here's what worked and here's what didn't work. And I think they like that.
What was the hardest part of transitioning from being a full-time operator to CEO to an operating partner?
I've been asked that a lot, and I'll tell you, it's so easy to answer. As an operator, you have an idea. You think you have a solution to it. You never know. Like, you're guessing and taking the best guess that possible, and you can actually go and take action against it. As an operating advisor, you see an issue or an issue is exposed and you're trying to solve that issue, but you cannot do it. You have to build trust in an alliance, and you have to count on other people to go do it. I tell you, that was a hard part for me because you want to go and you want to just get it done because that's what you've always operated before. And as an operating advisor, you have to really bank on the fact that people are going to do it and trust you. So I think building the relationship and the EQ side of it and getting to know the people becomes just as important as the business.
How do you build that muscle of learning how to lead more with influence and understanding rather than lead from the front?
You got to listen a lot. As I'm working with executives, this was the same way when I hired you. I was telling you that you build the business and you start building great people around you. In each stage of that, you're learning from those people. I've been a CEO for 15 years now. I'm learning all the time. So you have the opportunity to learn from these people. I think it's the same thing when you're working with executives and your operating advisor is they bring stuff to the table. So there's takeaways and I'll show them. I'll be like, look, that's a great idea. I would implement that as a CEO that you're doing. But here's some perspective from my perspective. So it's almost like trading of ideas more than me just going in and pointing out what their flaws are. I think if you can build that type of relationship, it's more successful, but they have to be open to it. We were open to it at ECI. If the executive team thinks you're coming to babysit them or to spy on them, they're not going to take your advice and it's not going to be fruitful. If they actually accept you and there's trust, then it'll be successful.
How did you go about working through that process? Because I think part of this also comes down to the management team being ready to have that kind of help around the table. There's a point in time when that team is ready. There's a point in time maybe when they're not. Or that maybe they should be ready, but they're just not quite at that point of being ready. How do you navigate all of that? Is really that's more kind of around the strategy of the private equity firm and the operating partner being able to work together to figure that out. But how do you go about that whole process?
I think every private equity firm has to have some sort of value add or value type of creation resources that can help advise these type of people and make, I guess it's not only be successful, but do it faster and accelerate faster and scale quicker. The days of it being Vista Equity and Thoma Bravo were the ones that did the operating. Everybody has them now. Everybody has operating advisors. Everybody's looking for that value add. I think the difference is the level of sort of force that you do it. Like how optional is it versus this is mandatory. And some will have, like a Vista will have their playbook and you're going to operate from their playbook. Carlisle was more of a, we are offering these services. We want to give you direction. But they have to accept it in a sense, but you have to find a way to work your way in. And that's the challenging part. That's the people part is like, hey, if they don't trust you, they're not going to open up. And once you can get past that, you can add value.
We talked a little bit earlier about private equity and venture kind of meeting in the middle, venture going a little bit upstream, private equity coming a little bit downstream, particularly when you get to growth stage technology companies. Do you think that the private equity model of operating partners will come more downstream as well, and you'll start to see more companies leverage this private equity-like operating model earlier on in their life cycle, or even kind of passing the baton to a more experienced CEO, having an exec chairman earlier on? Do you think those things are going to start to happen as these two worlds kind of merge together a little bit?
I do. This is a world according to Ron. I actually believe it will. And this is not even because I'm an operating partner right now. This is the way I felt as a CEO. If I had somebody that can advise you in those stages, and it's really every stage. Yes, as you start to scale 100 million, 200 million, 300 million, it becomes definitely a different model. And you really have to learn to scale at that point. But you're learning in the early days is, and you can accelerate past these headwinds if you understand how to do it. What's happening now is it started with these general operators that come in from a private equity firm and try to coach you on operations in general and how to run a business. Now there's very specific, like the private equity firm will have a go-to-market person, they'll have a product person, they'll have a systems person that will come in and help you in all these areas. It's getting more precise and direct on how they want to do it. And I think it'll come downstream as well. I think it's relevant all across the continuum of scale.
When Carlisle brought you on as an operating partner, what role were they looking to fill within their stable of operating partners?
I don't know what they're thinking. I believe, almost like talking to you earlier, is I had a perspective of each side. I had a sales background. I had a little bit of a finance background. I had M&A background. And then obviously I had the operations side. So I think it's one of those, I don't know, a little bit more of an athlete than it was a specialist. And I think that that can be helpful regardless of the opportunity. But then the specialist can actually dive in and really turn a little bit more detail into something that can be more beneficial for the company. So I think they liked the fact that I had the sort of both the organic growth and the inorganic growth. And I think every business now is looking for ways to grow, whether that's scaling through M&A or scaling organically. So if you can add that flavor to it, it helps.
Well, you're an athlete who just got drafted with the first pick recently because you became the first pick, the CEO of NetHealth. You've gone from operating partner, which you still are, to now also being the CEO of a company called NetHealth. Walk us through that process and why did you decide to take the reins as a CEO again?
Yeah, I literally said I would never be a CEO again. I don't know why, but when I left it, I think it was just the time of my career. But here I am full circle with the CEO again. I started to serve on boards at Carlisle. In addition to my chairman role at ECI, I was executive chairman of a company called Abrigo that's in fintech software. I work with a company called HireVue that's in human resource capital software. And then I was working with NetHealth, which is more on the healthcare side. NetHealth I was with for about a year. There was obviously some rumblings and some changes that sort of happened quickly from a CEO perspective. And they asked me if I would step in an interim basis. You know how that works. So at first I said, no, I'm going to be a CEO again. And then after some discussions, I decided to step in, and now I'm not even stepping in. I love it. I love the people. I love the team. I feel loyalty. I want to win. So here I am back to running a company again in a different vertical market, which I'm ramping up and learning. But yeah, it's been great. I really enjoy it again.
What's the hardest part of becoming the CEO of a different company in a different market? And where I'm going with this question is, you built a company to scale. You were at a company from $0 in revenue all the way to, I think, now 500 million plus and a few hundred million in EBITDA. You took over CEO around 50 million or so in revenue. So maybe there's some correlation between what it was like stepping into ECI's CEO seat with that type of size and scale of business and then scaling it 10x or so. NetHealth is a different industry, maybe a slightly similar place to where you were when you stepped into the CEO seat. How much do those skills transfer over versus being in a totally different market?
It was actually my hardest part. I grew up in ECI. I was there for the first dollar of revenue. I know every one of these vertical markets. I know where every skeleton was. I know the deals we've did over the years, every M&A acquisition I was a part of. So as I was running that business, there was nothing that I wasn't in the details of or had great knowledge over. And I knew the verticals. I could talk the talk. I knew the nomenclature. I knew the type of customers were in each vertical. I knew our software platforms. I knew even acronym within the company. And then you go to a completely different vertical in healthcare, and I didn't know it. And I'll tell you, Michael, my first 30 days, I was like, what did I do? This is a mistake. I'm ramping up all over again and starting from scratch. But what I realized is, as I started getting the basics down and understanding and spending time with customers and the people, is it's SaaS software. We're all experiencing the same type of challenges. Yes, the vertical understanding, you have to know it to be successful. But at the same time, you're going to see the same challenges. We're coming up on 200 million at NetHealth. And they're going through the same sort of growth stages that ECI went through, and really the pains of growth. And so I think I could still add that perspective, learn the markets on the go, and rely on the people that have been in the company for years to handle that side while I handle the high level.
How do you handle not being as familiar with a market, having not been in that industry for quite some period of time, and still running and trying to grow and scale this business? That must be a hard challenge.
Yes, it's different. You have to rely on people. I restructured a business at NetHealth. I felt like they needed a more of a business unit structure, which we had similar to ECI, more focused within each of these independent areas of the companies. We made that change, which helped a little bit because each one of those areas has a division president that can run the specifics of that business. But yeah, I think it's the hardest part. I am still scaling. I feel so much more comfortable in month 6 than I did in month 1. And I'm sure in month 12, it'll be the same way. But now I'm just starting to shift my mindset of, okay, what's the value creation opportunity within the business? And regardless of what industry you're in, there's similar type of metrics and opportunities.
So being a CEO, particularly as one who restructured the org of a business to a different structure, as you just mentioned, what do you think your role is as the CEO? What do you focus on most as you think about driving value from where it is today to where you want to go?
I talk about this a lot with our leadership team, and we have very clear meetings. Being in private equity, I think you never succeed if you're building a business for an event. So in other words, okay, look, we're going to sell in 2025. So let me build the business and optimize that business for the event. You have to build the business for the long term, because once again, the people coming in are super smart. They're going to diligence you, and they're going to recognize if you're building it for an event versus the long term. And they're underwriting the future, not what you've done historically. I think that's interesting. And the perspective I bring to the leadership team, I think I was through account raising capital and exits 5 or 6 at ECI. So as you go through that process, you understand what to look for in value creation. And that's where I've tried to center the team around.
So internally, how do you define what enterprise value is to the employees so that everyone throughout the organization, like you mentioned, culture is so important. How does that concept of enterprise value creation cascade all the way down to every employee?
ECI had a very similar, I think, perception at certain parts of the organization. Is we're an EBITDA value type of company, and most of them are going to be that. ECI was, NetHealth will be the same way. I think sometimes EBITDA within a company, the perception of the employees, it comes across as a negative thing. Like it's bad to make money or to profit because you're doing that at the cost of helping a customer or paying employees or whatever it is. And you have to shift that mindset. They can be independent of each other. And I always use the example at ECI is that we were a 4% grower in the early days of ECI, and we were like 33% EBITDA margins. And then we became a 12% grower and we're 38% EBITDA margin, which just shows that they're exclusive from each other. You don't have to do one if you run a better business. So I guess going back to your question, you have to educate employees. So we're spending a lot of time educating them on here's how you create value.
Well, educating people on we expanded revenues, and with expanding revenues, we expanded EBITDA margin. That's generally a good thing. How would you go about educating employees on what EBITDA meant in terms of how this business is valued? Because I feel like that's a thing where day to day, if you're in a business, you may not fully internalize that. And sure, it may be a challenge to do that, but is there anything you can do to help employees understand and internalize what it means to create enterprise value, have EBITDA, and why that's important for the business?
It's a tough one. I think you have to educate them. Everybody should be knowledgeable of the financials and your progress and how you're doing against your goals. I don't think that could ever be bad. Why would that be a bad thing to understand? Everybody recognizing the areas we're being successful and the areas we may see some headwinds. I think educating and make sure you're sharing and communicating that is the starting point. But here's what I'll flip it over a little bit though, is it can't be the only focus. Like, culture's a big focus. We have a bunch of employee resource groups at NetHealth. One of them they just created it's a Swifty ERG, which is like Taylor Swift. It can be anything, but it gives them the community and the opportunity to be together and spend time for people that like the same things. It can't be all EBITDA. There has to be the EBITDA and fun and camaraderie and all that type of stuff as well. I'll tell you a real quick story. The general counselor interviewed me in front of the entire company in my first 2 weeks just for them to get to know me. And we had all these questions that he would ask me. Well, he started going off script and he's like, look, I'm going to say words and you tell me which one, like guacamole or salsa. And I'm like, queso, because I don't like either one. But he went and he's like, are you a Swifty? And I said, what's a Swift? This is pre-Kelsey. I had no idea. He was looking at me, he's like, you don't know what a Swifty is. The backlash I got from the employees in week one was brutal. So it's become a joke in the organization.
Maybe one of the best ways to teach people about EBITDA is to show the impact that Taylor Swift's had on the NFL.
Yeah, look, she's a business phenomenon, for sure.
Throughout this whole conversation, it's really been about how do you balance both building a business with building a culture? And it's not just about business. It has to be about people too. You're in this operating partner role. You're obviously CEO, but you're also still in this operating partner role. Where do you think that takes you, and how do you see the evolution of the operating partner for yourself over time?
I think I'll do the CEO. I'll see it through for NetHealth, however long I stay here. I think I'll end up back as an operating partner. I really did like it. I think once again, I was actually just giving advice to another one of my colleagues that wants to move an operating partner and been very successful as a CRO. And I tell him, look, you've got to get over the fact that you can't implement everything. You can't do it. So once you get past that, the concept of working with a bunch of different companies and different people and seeing different types of investment theses or ways of adding value or customer sets or people, cultures, I think it's great. I love that side of it. And I think operating partners will have a role for a long time. I want to be one that people want to work with as opposed to the one that are forced upon them. So I think there's a balance there for sure.
Well, you just mentioned that you gave advice. What was the best piece of advice that you've ever got?
It was a long time ago. I was at Lucent Technologies and a guy I admired a ton. He told me not everybody's you. It took me a while to digest it. And it just made me realize and think about the fact that everybody has different likes and dislikes. And what's important to one person is not important to the other. And as you become a manager, you have to recognize you may have 8 direct reports or 10 direct reports. And each one of those is going to have independent goals of what's success to them. Learning that part and understanding it and realizing that everybody doesn't have the same sort of trajectory or goals that you have, I think it was important. It's a people business at the end of the day.
How do you figure out how to motivate people in that context, particularly as you scale too? You have to figure out not everybody's you. They all have different goals and desires. Yes. How do you motivate people in that context?
I talk about communication and sharing. I think regardless of what your goals are, people like camaraderie. They like to win. They like to feel like they have partners and friends at the business. In millennials, it's a different world. As you know, a lot of people care more about the culture than they care about anything right now. So I think there's a way of balancing culture and fun with success. I think the good people and the good leaders right now are going to do it. If you don't care about the people, they'll sense it and then you'll lose the good people. It's definitely part of business for sure.
I get the sense that from a private equity perspective, people is still so core to what they do, but in addition to that, given that you've talked about that a bunch, what do you think has been the most impactful lesson or takeaway you've learned from working with private equity?
Having alignment and communication between private equity and the teams is critical. I think that's why I had such a great private equity experience, is that we knew each other, we were aligned, we shared stuff back and forth, and it was a partnership versus a owner portfolio company mentality. And I think that's critical. And I think the good firms will do it that way. There's still people and they want to be handled the way they want to be handled. And I think if you build that relationship, people are going to go fight so much harder for you if they know you personally. So I don't know, it's been just a big shift for me. And that's the kind of operating advisor I want to be as well.
I love that, acting like an owner in everything that you do. The great transition to the question that I ask everyone on this podcast as the final question, which is, it's related to being an owner. It's, what is your favorite or most interesting alternative investment?
I don't know. That's a tough question. What's yours?
A great question. I would say it's the business that we've created at Broadhaven. I think at the end of the day, the business that you build, or the one that you have the most invested in, is ultimately the most important thing you can do. It's an expression of yourself. It's an expression of all the things that you're doing. And focus ends up being so important, right? So from my perspective there, I mean, the other piece of it too is we're a business that invests into other businesses or helps build other businesses. I have a lot of businesses that I really enjoy working with or were a part of, iCapital being one of them. But I think at the end of the day, you have to kind of find who you are and what you like to do. I know myself, I like doing a lot of different things at once. Doesn't mean that they're all not tied together and they don't kind of all fit together in terms of being synergistic, but I had to find something that could be the vehicle for that. And I think my partner, Greg, is fantastic at helping to build that same vision with me. And I think we've built that in doing so. So it has to be what we're building ourselves. So I think we are, to some extent, investing in ourselves.
No, and I think it actually feeds into what I was going to say, which is, in general, I think creating worth, and part of my side of being in multiple exits with private equity firms, every time we had the opportunity to double down on ourselves and sort of roll over and reinvest back in ourselves, which you control at the end of the day, like all these other investments and alternative investments and everything you're talking about, stock exchange, anything that you're investing in, you're counting on other people to perform. And in our world, and which is why I like private equity, you can double down on yourself and you control that investment, which has been super fruitful.
Spoken like a true operator. No wonder you're back as a CEO. You can control the outcome in a positive way, and you know that all the work that you're going to do is going to be what's going to get you there.
Totally. Once again, it's you get in when you put out, you get out when you put in, and that's what you do with running a business, for sure.
So you're in the perfect seat then, being an operator once again. I love it. This is a great way to put a bow tie on this conversation, because you've gone from operator, successfully selling your business, to operating partner, to CEO. And you're investing in yourself once again.
Full circle, full circle. Thanks so much, man. I appreciate it.
Love it. It was a pleasure to have you on, Ron. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Michael.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Alt Goes Mainstream. I hope you enjoyed it. You can find more episodes of the podcast at any of your favorite podcast sites. And you can read more about alts at my Substack, altgoesmainstream.substack.com. And follow me on Twitter at Michael Sidgemore and @GoesAlt. Thanks a lot and have a great day. We're going.